Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Financial Translator, where we discuss financial topics in layman's terms to move you from confusion to confidence on a given topic. I am your host, Kirk Krekemeyer, the Principal Advisor at Pebble Valley Wealth Management. We are a fee-only financial advisory firm helping our clients make informed decisions on their road toward financial security. You can find more information at pvwealthmgt.com. On today's show, I'm going to discuss 10 financial tips for newlyweds. I've done blog posts in the past for new graduates and people with summer jobs, but this is my first one for newlyweds. So this podcast was inspired by some of my kids' friends getting married this past summer. So I just want to give a quick shout out to a couple of pilots who are regular listeners of this podcast. So first of all, thanks for listening. Congrats on your wedding. And who knows, maybe one of you will start putting some ketchup on your eggs, but I digress. So back to the podcast here. You can also reference my blog post on this topic. This time, there's not any graphs for this month's podcast, but I do have a couple of links to past topics. And so worthwhile checking out my blog post as well. Again, pvwealthmgt.com, blogs, and you'll find this here. As a brief legal disclaimer, my discussions here should not be construed as financial or investment advice, and each person's situation is unique. All right, let's go. So I'm going to lay this out as 10 financial tips to go over now that you're newlyweds, some few things to consider. I'm not sure if some of you are old enough to remember the newlywed game. You definitely got some interesting questions and answers on that show. So I doubt that any of these topics would have made it to the newlywed game questions, but I bet some of your discussions may be just as surprising as some of those interesting responses that you. The 10 financial topics for newlyweds. The first one is going to be communicate. Now, you may not think that's a financial topic, and I agree directly it's not a financial topic, but you know, as a happily married man of 31 years, I can say that communication is extremely important. So whether it's financial or otherwise, the tougher the topic, the more important to have it. But the first financial tip in general, financial and otherwise, communicate. Don't let topics fester. Second topic, individual versus joint accounts. So up to now, most of the accounts that you likely owned were titled in your name only. There are some accounts that have to be titled in your name only, even after you got married, like 401ks, IRAs, HSAs, life insurance products, annuities, etc. So those still must be in your name only. However, if you have bank accounts or taxable brokerage accounts that you're investing excess savings in, up to now, those were likely just titled in your name. Those can be, and they can stay that way as well, but especially for some of the bank accounts, you can now create a joint account. You list both of you on those accounts. You're equal owners. You have full authority to do what you want with it. But the nice thing is it just adds simplicity. So instead of having two accounts and where the bill's coming from and who's balancing both of them, just having one checking account, one joint checking account for depositing payroll paychecks, doing your setting up your monthly payments just simplifies things. And it also reinforces the combined effort. You got married, working together, build a life together. So having the joint account helps reinforce that from a financial perspective as well. It's pretty easy to do. You just, whatever the institution, the bank, or the brokerage that you have, you will have to open up a new account. So you want to go in there and create, or online, you should handle it that way. Create a new joint account with both of you on there. And then once it's opened up, you can transfer in assets, from those individual accounts into there. There's no tax implications. There's no gifting implications among spouses. So no worries other than just doing it. The third topic, do you do combined finances or separate finances? So I'm going to start. I think most people probably do approaching their finances on a combined basis. And so, again, you just got married. You're coming together to build a life together. Each bring in your own skills and characteristics and unique things to the marriage. And so most people will pool their finances and to build, build on it together. Can be different for some, depending upon as each of you are bringing on the financial side, bringing assets to the table, that they could differ substantially. But again, talk through it. But again, most people will look at things on a combined basis. The other thing to remember, too, is, throughout life. And so again, just got married, you got many, many years ahead of you. And guess what? Life changes, right? So you're doing things, there's different phases of life. And so having it on a combined basis can be very helpful because, you know, maybe one of you wants to start going back to school, grad school or something. Your income may be very low, but if you have pooled finances, again, together, you work on shared goals, you can get through it. You may be having children. Different income levels may change during the child-rearing years for some, or starting your own business. You know, that's what I did back when I was 43. So, again, quick shout-out. Thanks to Meg and the kids for putting up with my early PVWM sacrifices, and even to this day, the time sacrifice. So thank you for that. But doing things on a combined basis, you've got both of you pulling together. You know, because, again, different phases of life, you'll need help from each of you as you go along. And you also may bring different debt obligations to the marriage. And so, again, back to that point number one, communicate, talk through it, and then knock off these goals together on a combined basis as you're working together for your shared goals and also respecting and retaining each of your individual goals as well. Some people do want to have it keeping their finances separate, but you know, it's that trade-off of, do you want to have it as a kind of a yours versus mine and figuring everything out, or, you know, just going with the ours, you know, ours is more powerful. If you do choose to keep it separate, definitely again, communicate, but also clarify, you know, how are you going to split those common costs? And then of course, if, when, and how would you use the other person's savings if necessary to cover some of those future needs in those examples I gave you. So whichever approach you take, you know, trust and communication is key. Just, you know, talk about what you expect from each and how you want to handle each so there's no resentments or, you know, things like that on different savings patterns or spending patterns. And so, because each person has a view of what they think is appropriate. So that's a great segue into number four, topic number four, preparing a combined finances budget. So, you know, what is appropriate? You know, what is appropriate spending or what are the appropriate categories that are important? Just a quick news flash for everybody here. You're going to have different opinions. So do it. Again, have the discussion. The key is to make sure you express what things are important to you. There's obviously the day-to-day living stuff. That's just what it is, and these are the bills we have to pay. There's probably some things that you enjoy doing that bring you satisfaction. So make sure that you express what those are. And for each of you, allowing the other to continue doing that. And so I like to call this, you know, giving the person financial oxygen. You know, you don't want to stifle thing and no, we can't do this. So everyone has their thing. Give each other the space to do that within reason, obviously, right? It's got to fit within the budget. But, you know, having your own thing is okay. And the one thing you want to avoid, too, is, you know, maybe one spouse has a more, whatever that cost is, maybe it's higher than the other one. You know, don't fall in the trap of kind of doing a, you know, match spending competition, because that can spiral downward pretty quickly. Another comment here, it's kind of related to the budget, but you know, paying the bills. So maybe one of you will be taking the lead on that, but which is what we do as well. So thank you, Meg, for doing that. But I recommend the other person at least be aware of what's going on and kind of where things are at. So you may not be doing it month to month, but don't be blind to it. You know, at least know where things are at, where the money's coming from, and how the process works in general terms. And then once you do establish a budget, again, it's you call it a savings generator tool or a spending tracking tool, prioritization of where you want your fun stuff to go. So, you know, budget doesn't have to be an evil word because it does great things for you. So once you've established that budget, it's also important to monitor where actual spending is going relative to that budget. And here I would just say, you know, let technology do the heavy lifting for you. You know, it'd be a pain in the ass to track each expense down. You don't want to do that. But if you use technology that's out there, it can make it pretty easy. And then you can focus on the more of the, oh, that's where it's going. Or we give our clients, we have a tracking tool that we give our clients on our portal. But on the retail side for, you know, do-it-yourselfers at home, you know, a couple of retail apps out there. There's a small fee, but Simplify by Quicken is one. That's a intuitive tool. And there's also a You Need a Budget, or YNAB, it's called, is another one that gets a bit deeper in things, but depending upon your style. Yes, there is a small fee for them. It's, you know, under $50, I think, or definitely under $100 for sure. But think of it as an investment. So some of you may say, well, no, don't worry, I'm going to use Mint. Two things warning there. One, it's going away at the end of this year. And two, if you're not paying for something, you're the product. And so just be careful with privacy, and you know, it's best to pay for a small nominal fee for stuff like this. This is the first place too. So I mentioned in the lead-in, I do have a previous blog post. So June of 2023, look up my blog post or past podcasts as well, called The Financial Framework for Your Early Career. And there I go pretty deep on tips on how to set in a budget and going through some examples. The fifth topic, fifth financial tip for the newlyweds, beneficiary changes. So I mentioned earlier that there are some accounts that must remain in your name only. They're tax-qualified accounts like the 401ks, IRAs, HSAs, life insurance, etc. You may or may not remember it, but when you open up those accounts, they would have asked you, who is the beneficiary? And so what the beneficiary means is you name a person who is going to receive this money when you die. That's what a beneficiary is. So, you know, you may have had one, somebody on there. You may have your parents or your siblings, or you probably have somebody on there. But I'd highly recommend now you go back into all those accounts and update your spouse as the primary beneficiary. Don't forget about some of those employer-provided life insurance plans, or if you're lucky enough to have a pension plan. There again, you may not remember doing it, but there is a beneficiary designation on stuff like that. Make sure you go in and update to your spouse. And don't worry, your parents and siblings who were likely listed on there right now will understand. Topic number six, updating your employer benefits. You would have gone through the process when you first got hired or started at a new company. You have 30 days to sign up for stuff. And then typically you have a chance to do it every year thereafter. They call it the annual employee benefit enrollment or something like that. However, there is an exception. And so one of those exceptions is after a major life event, you can go in and update or re-request the benefits that make sense for you after this major life event. And one of those major life events is marriage. So you do have the opportunity to go in and update benefits. Now, typically, it's only open for the next 30 days after the event. So you want to move somewhat quickly on this after you get back from the honeymoon. If it's past 30 days, whatever the deadline is, you may have missed it. But so it's a good opportunity to go in. The main difference is, or main thing to look at, is reassess what employer health benefits are out there. And oftentimes, if you're each working for a company, one of the employer plans may be better to fit your situation. So definitely worth looking at each and picking the best of the the employer health plan. Just a little side note, I'm a big fan of health savings accounts. So if you're comfortable with high deductible plans and you missed it last time, here's a chance to have a redo. And the same applies for all benefits. And so, you know, long-term disability, for example, is one I'm a big fan of making sure people sign up for. So if you didn't last time, you can update all of your benefits with this open enrollment. And this is a quick aside. Some people think, well, I'm married now, I need to get more life insurance. I would say not necessarily. So unless you have children, or maybe it's a large debt that the one brought to the marriage, that if that person passed away as a single survivor, you wouldn't be able to handle that debt load, then there's a situations where you might consider it. But just because you're married doesn't mean you need more life insurance. So just as a quick aside. Here too, this is an example where I do have a past blog post. So my October 2023 blog post and podcast, it's titled It's Happening, Annual Benefits Enrollment. So you can reference that for some considerations for the employee benefit selection if you're still within that open window period after the major life event of marriage. Topic number seven, this is the fun one, tax returns. So in the past, you were filing your tax return. That's good, it's required, but you were doing it as a single filer. And now, more than likely, you're going to be doing it as a married filing jointly. I'm not going to get into married filing separately here. So just focusing going from single to a married filing jointly. I'm not an accountant, but I do know taxes quite well. So here we go. So the key point, first point number one, as long as you're married on December 31st of a given year, you can file a joint return for that entire year. So those who just had your summer and fall weddings, again, congrats. You get to file a joint return for the full 2023 calendar year. So no funky pro rata. So don't worry about that. The most obvious benefit you're going to see, or the most difference, I guess, you're going to see is you're now going to be in the different tax brackets, the married filing jointly tax brackets, which are basically double what they were for a single. So if both of you are coming to have similar income for each of you, you may not notice much of a difference there because it's the brackets are, you know, you're going to be in a similar tax bracket, just in a higher on a combined basis. But one area where you could notice a difference is if one of you has a substantially different income. One of you may have been, say, for example, in a 22% bracket and one in the 12% bracket. Well, on a combined basis now, the benefit to you is going to be for that income that was normally the 22%, a portion of that will get run through at the 12%. So there will be some tax savings if each of you have somewhat different income. The other thing you will notice is standard deduction. So again, 2023, for a single, it was $13,850, but for a married filing jointly, it's going to be $27,700. So again, double, but interesting thing here is starting in 2017, they cap, it's called a SALT, the state and local tax limit. They cap that at $10,000, but interestingly, that's capped at $10,000 whether you file as a single or a married filing jointly. So you single filers, if you're in a high tax state like Illinois, and if you're a property owner, you get tapped out there, but that $10,000 was pretty close to the that $13,850. So some of you may have been itemizing on a single filer. Well, yes, now that you're married, that SALT is still capped at $10,000. So now your standard is up to $27,700. So unless you have, you know, close to $18,000 of other itemized deductions on Schedule A for you detail gamers at home, you may not have enough to itemize anymore. So you'll just pick up the standard. So don't be surprised if that starts popping up. One not so obvious impact is has to do with individual retirement account IRA stuff. There are limits. It's based upon modified adjusted gross income, so not quite taxable. But there are limits if you want to do a Roth contribution directly. You're going to have limits that will stop you, and so those look at those. You now have higher. It's definitely not double, but higher, so that gives you more room. But also on the traditional side, everybody can contribute to a traditional. The question is it deductible? And that's driven by income as well. But it gets kind of funky. It varies depending upon if you or both of you have a 401k plan at work. So look at the tables or research it or call for help if you don't know. But that's going to impact maybe some of your traditional IRAs are deductible if you're doing that. Or if you're doing Roths, then you may have eligibility that you can actually start doing it. What else here? Oh, so the other thing, again, if you have had different incomes between the two of you, depending upon your income for the year, now that you're in the joint filer, you may find that this first year, your joint income maybe is in a lower tax bracket. Maybe one of you just started working with a full-time job. So next year, you know you're going to be in the, say, 22 as an example. But this year, yeah, you're in the 12 because you got this high, the bracket for taxable income. So after the standard deduction of 27 and change, is $89,450 to be exact. If your income is below that, you're in the 12% bracket. If you find yourself there, I'm a big fan of doing Roth conversions and filling up whatever bracket you're in versus what you think you'll be long term. And so if you're in the 12, I would definitely fill it for sure. 22, I would even consider filling, but that gets more detail, need more information to find out. But if you're in the 12, I would say fill it, and so you fill that with a Roth conversion. Look into it. If you have questions, call or reach out for help. And here again, blog post, previous reference. So it looks like May of 2023. I have a blog post and podcast called Your 2022 Tax Return is Talking. Listen. So check that out. Definitely I'd recommend the blog post there for sure as well. Because I do have some nice the tax tables, and so I show both single and joint filers and where those breakpoints are. So definitely check it out. There's always I always say with taxes, if you find value, there's always good value to find there, and that is risk-free, no-cost return for you. So you can do some things, you know, save a few thousand in taxes. That's money in your pocket without having to take on market risk. Topic number 8. So how are we doing on time? 20 minutes. So topic number 8: spousal IRAs. I'm going to say this is a gem that is often overlooked. I often come across when I'm working with new clients and not everybody, both parties don't have an IRA. So the concept is, in order to contribute to an IRA and or a 401k, you need to have what's called eligible taxable compensation. You need to have wages. So that's typically, if you're both working, that's not a problem. You both have wages. But just so you know, and just as a quick aside, you can contribute to a 401k and an IRA. So 2023, the max for young folks is $22,500 under age 50 into a 401k. In addition to that, you can also contribute $6,500 for under age 50 into an IRA. So have at it if you've got excess savings. And then again, Roth versus traditional, it gets complicated, but look at the rules. And if you can, and you're in a lower bracket, go for the Roth. Back to this topic. So spousal IRAs. So you may find that one spouse, if they're working part-time or if they're not working at all, different phases, they're going back to school or something, they can still utilize the spouse's compensation to qualify for the IRA. Not necessarily a 401k if they're not working, but for individual IRAs, they definitely can. So I would definitely make sure if you've got the income or excess taxable savings somewhere, money's fungible, you know, rely upon your spouse's eligible compensation and hit that IRA for both of you. It's called a spousal IRA. Topic number 9, legal documents. And so you may be thinking, legal documents, that's for old people like my parents, right? The answer is no, that's wrong. It's for everybody. So again, I'm not an attorney here either. I don't draft legal documents by any stretch. However, there are a few basic documents that everybody should have. So I'm not saying that you need to engage an attorney and set up some complex estate plan with various trusts and stuff like that. That's not what I'm saying here. But I'm going to say there are four legal documents that everyone should have. It's a will. That's going to be specifying where your non-beneficiary accounts go. So a key distinction here, beneficiary designations overrule a will. So you can't just say, oh, I got a will, I'm not going to worry about those beneficiary designations. The answer to that is no. You want to fill them out and update them. You know, if you have your parents and your siblings on there from the old days, don't think that your will is going to correct that. You need to change the beneficiary form. But a will handles then everything else, you know, bank accounts, you know, cars, property if you're over certain amounts. But the other interesting thing, again, maybe it's too early for, you're not thinking of children right now or don't have them, but when you start having children, a will also does a very important thing for young couples with children, and that is it names the legal guardian for your children. So God forbid if you both were to pass, who do you want raising your children? You specify that person's name in the will. Two other documents, powers of attorney, one for healthcare, one for property. Basically, this, you name the person who you want to make your decisions, whether it's medical or financial decisions. You're still alive, but maybe unable, whether it's whatever incapacity. And so typically you'll have them and you'll name your spouse. And then again, you can name a secondary person who would fill that role. Living will, not a fun topic, but recommend having it. You know, again, those end of life measures, how far do you want to go on your behalf? Because you're not going to be able to tell them that. Because so anyway, living will, not a fun topic, but necessary to have, in my opinion. I already talked about beneficiary designation, so just make sure you keep them current. And then topic number 10. So I guess I hold in my hand the last envelope here. So topic number 10, view your investment accounts on a combined basis. So this one, actually, I broke out three subtopics. I'll just very briefly touch upon them. So on a combined basis, you now have, you know, all of you have, you know, 401ks, joint accounts, taxable accounts. First thing is focus on asset allocation. So I'm a big fan of looking at stuff on a combined basis. I don't need to have each account fully diversified, but I want to make sure on a combined basis, the overall pie is diversified. And then I put stuff in where it makes tax sense, but that's a different topic. So here, I'd recommend doing that, but now you're combining your spouse's accounts as well. So, and again, using my oxygen analogy, here I would say, you know, allow for some risk oxygen here. So one of you, or maybe both of you, enjoy individual stock picking or theme investing or whatever, and that can be fun. So, you know, don't want to do everything with it, but, you know, allow some risk oxygen for those who do enjoy it. And maybe allocate a portion, say 10%, for activities like that. Second subtopic under these combined accounts is risk tolerance. And so you each may have a different level of how much risk you're comfortable taking. So it's important to know where each of you are on that. You know, we have a tool for the clients that we use to find out where each person is at, and then we talk through it and we come up with an allocation that's comfortable for both of them. Here again, let's provide some oxygen. This time, let's provide some safety oxygen, and that is one of you may want to make sure you have some safe stuff here. I'm a full fan of that as well, but focusing on the reserve fund for that. So, but if one of you is more or less risk tolerant, just respect that. Don't overdo it, but goes the other way as well. You don't want to take too little risk because you have a long time horizon and you got to keep up with inflation. And then finally, subtopic of this number 10, combined accounts, custodian viewing. So this is more of I call it the love letter to Schwab. We use Schwab as our main custodian. When you're single, you log in and you can see all your accounts. When you're married, maybe your wife or your husband has an IRA that you would like to see when you log in as well, just to keep things simple. So contact the custodian and ask for shared viewing or whatever they call it. There'll be some form to fill out, but that way you can see everything. Again, back to that communication concept, full transparency is a great way to start with everything. Full transparency helps in the communication. So being able to see all the accounts is good. If you want to take it to the next step, combining custodians might be a good thing just to keep things simple, like whether it's Schwab, Fidelity, IB, Interactive Brokers, Vanguard, etc. So you can move accounts. Again, no cost, no tax implications. It's just open up the new account and transferring it to simplify your life now that you're married. Obviously, you can't move your current 401k, so those have to stay at the employer. But past 401ks, you can combine and things like that. So check it out. So there you have it. My 10 financial tips for newlyweds you can discuss. Doesn't have to be all at once. There's a lot here, but some of them may not be candlelit dinner type of concepts either. But find the time to discuss them. Make sure you're both in the right spot and the right framework to discuss them. But do it. Just definitely go through and do it. It'll start you down a nice path of, if not marital financial bliss, at least it's a nice foundation to put you on a solid foundation as you move forward. And then the rest is up to you, of course. And again, make sure you remember to communicate. All right, that's a wrap on today's topic. Thanks a lot. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Financial Translator. I hope this discussion helped clear up any confusion and will lead to more confident financial decisions. Thanks for your time, and be sure to check out all of our resources at pvwealthmgt.com. Until next time, go confidently.